First of all, hello and welcome, obviously, to the online event, and it's called Refusing Discriminatory Technologies of Power, Racial Justice and the Challenge of High-Tech Policing. So we're holding this at the International Inequalities Institute here at the LSE. My name is Ellen Helsburn, and I'm a professor in social digital inequalities at the Department of Media and Communications here at the LSE, as well as the convener of the research theme Politics of Inequality at the International Inequalities Institute, who is hosting this event, as I said earlier. So today's speaker is Dr. Sita Peña Gangadharan. She is associate professor in the Department of Media and Communications at the LSE, and she will be presenting on the topic of technology, injustice, and inequity, with the focus on the kind of bottom-up practices of resistance to the digital and the automated systems that increasingly govern people's lives. Her talk will investigate the narrative, technical, and political challenges faced by members of minoritized communities in encountering these discriminatory technologies of power. She will draw from examples of data-driven policing in Europe and the United States, ultimately asking, what can affected communities learn from other practices of technological refusal? So we are recording this event at the LSE. We are going to decide whether it's going to be uploaded and distributed to the wider public afterwards. We are not live streaming it, in case people were wondering about this. We could make it available as a video or a podcast afterwards, but that's still up for debate depending on what we decide afterwards. So please note that today's event is a meeting rather than a kind of an event or a webinar. So we would like to see as many of you as possible, as I already said. So if you could keep yourself muted, but turn your camera on when possible, that would be great. And then especially the muting will ensure a smooth running event. So there will be a chance for you to pose questions to the speaker, like in the last 20 minutes of the event, which runs until 1:30. Please use the raise hand function for those of you who know how that works in your kind of your chat box. You should be able to see a little hand, or if you do participants, you can raise your hand, little blue hand. You can ask also in the chat. We'll keep an eye on the chat. And please, if you do that, state your name and affiliation so that we can know who you are and where you come from. And then once Sita finishes with her presentation, we can also ask you to pose your question yourself by unmuting your microphone. So that was about what we are just about to experience. A few announcements about upcoming events at the IAI. Tomorrow we have the Hares and the Managers and the Bureaucrats, Sketching Economic Power in Contemporary France. And it's the first event in a new seminar series called Building Collaborations in the Sociological Analysis of European Elites. And this will take place at 12:30 p.m. So please do register for that. Then on next Tuesday, we have the next event in the Inequality Seminar Series. And that's entitled Phases of Inequality, a Mixed Methods Approach to Multidimensional Inequalities. This is also at 12:30. Like the event tomorrow. So, and the details for both of these events can obviously be found on the IAI's website, but also in the chat. So that was all for me. I will hand over to Sita, and thank you so much everyone for joining the event, and please enjoy it. And we're looking forward to all the questions that you might pose and the discussion that will ensue afterwards. Over to you, Sita.
Thanks so much, Ellen, and thank you to the International Inequalities Institute, also the other co-convener of the Politics of Inequality theme at III, Armina Ishkenian, and also to the community of organizers and activists that I've worked with over the past, including those community members that I've collaborated with in my capacity as co-lead of our data bodies, as well as some of the participants or table members in the Justice, Equity, and Technology table, the Justice, Equity, and Technology Project. So I just wanted to share those acknowledgements. This is, as Ellen previewed, more of a meeting, and it's meant to be more interactive. It's one of those discussions where I'm presenting some new material and still working out ideas. And so, you know, I think that I'm certainly guilty of having a somewhat provocative description with not necessarily the most cohesive set of answers to the questions and challenges that I pose. But I'm hoping to engage in some conversation with you about these ideas, because I feel very strongly that these are ideas that do require our collective thinking, and not just our sort of intellectual engagements with the issue, but also our thoughts and energies around strategizing and organizing. So as Ellen mentioned, I study technology and look at questions of their governance and social justice. So I just my talk is divided probably into five-ish parts. And I want to spend the first 5 or so minutes just kind of establishing how I see technology and how I see these questions of power in relation to data-driven policing. So again, my research orientation is at the intersection of technology, governance, and social justice. And so when I'm talking about technology, I'm referring to systems of power, systems which organize wealth, privilege, and political influence in particular ways. And I draw heavily from the work of the political economist of communication and information, Oscar Gandhi, who used this term discriminatory technologies of power to describe the new kinds of digital tools that have emerged over the past 30 plus years that categorize us, extract information about us, categorize us, and try to extract value and try to nudge our behavior on the basis thereof. So in this sense, because I think we're coming from a variety of backgrounds, if I look at this participant list and make some inferences about it, this differs from other scholars and practitioners, arguably, who see technology as a variable that you can introduce into some sort of environment that then causes certain kinds of outcomes or a change in a particular population. So introduce technology, and that might have impacts on wealth, knowledge, or civic participation. I take a different approach, right? I'm starting from the premise, and I come from a school of thought and a tradition that sees technology as a driver of a distinctive form of informational capitalism that in this current context can be racialized. So this discussion rests on the premise that digital and often automated technologies connect to racialized surveillance capitalism, whereby information about people's behavior, their digital footprints, their various different behaviors that are digitizable and can be plugged into these automated computer systems, whereby information about people's behavior is extracted and used in ways that privilege a racialized social hierarchy. So that's kind of the starting point, right? I'm not coming from this, you know, I've had the privilege of working with a number of political scientists and sociologists recently for a volume on digital technology and democratic theory. And we would always have these debates about what technology is. And I see it as a system of power, again, in line with Oscar Gandhi. Discriminatory technologies of power, in fact, is what I'm interested in this particular case in this conversation. So nowhere is this more evident than in the context of policing, where increasingly we are seeing influx or the adoption and implementation of new high-tech tools to extend the powers of police authorities here in London, here throughout Europe, in the United States, though we also see this in different parts of the world, for example, in South Africa, we're seeing extensive implementation of surveillance technologies, police tech, high-tech police tools such as gun detection technology, alongside of extensive surveillance camera networks. To just contextualize to provide some context in Europe, based on the work of my colleagues Esra Oskan and Sana Stevens, we know that already in Europe Europe already criminalizes racialized and minoritized communities, such as with border strategies or border policies, anti-terrorism, and domestic policing effort. And I'll just bring up really quickly some of the work that in which they outline these arguments, where they look at policing and high-tech policing in Europe to explain that, okay, we already have structural racism and institutionalized racism within the policing apparatus in Europe. And now what we're seeing is the introduction of high-tech policing or policies and practice that focus on data-driven tools or data-driven systems, be they facial recognition tools, sort of the next wave in automated license plate readers, different databases like gang databases, predictive policing tools. We're seeing the influx of these tools or the sort of excitement within policing context, excitement about adopting these new tools, which then get layered on top of an already problematic institutionalized form of structural racism within police authorities and border authorities. So we're seeing these tools adopted, developed in-house. We're seeing some of these tools as a product of public-private partnerships, right, where you're contracting with private vendors. And again, as the title of this blog suggests, there's a deep nexus between the structural racism and the practices that we've seen that demonstrate patterns of racial profiling, abuse and violence towards racialized and minoritized populations. And we're seeing these tools adopted in ways that extend sort of the market for the growing market for surveillance technologies. So in the United States, the situation, I think, has become far more well known. And so the situation of hyper-surveillance and over-policing of Black communities and communities of color is so extensive and has become a much talked about issue in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, right? And somewhat cynically, you could say, what's happened in the United States with respect to adoption, implementation, public-private partnerships between police authorities and private technology companies, right? That you could say very cynically that this has become a litmus test or a site to watch or a case study in how not to adopt or implement data-driven policing or high-tech policing, because there has been so much outrage and publicity around the potential coerciveness and violence of these new tools. So for example, in the United States, since the murder of George Floyd, there's been a 1-year moratorium on facial recognition technology adopted by Microsoft and Amazon, saying, you know, oh, we sort of sympathize with the concerns for racial justice in the United States, and we're going to hold off before implementing these tools. Nevertheless, in the United States, even in the face of public outrage and the murder of George Floyd, keep in mind that Amazon Ring, the smart, secure doorbell tech that you actually here in London, I'm seeing more and more of as people want to monitor who's leaving packages on their doorstep. Amazon Ring sales have increased, and Ring now has partnerships with hundreds of police departments nationwide in the United States. That comes with sharing agreements or data sharing agreements that allow essentially consumer or private data to be shared with police departments in the pursuit of quote unquote public safety. So when I'm talking about technological refusal, I'm talking in relation to these contexts, right? A context in the European, in Europe, where we're sort of at a more nascent stage, but where institutions have the capacity to learn from how, for example, high-tech policing is implemented and adopted in the United States. And I just want to unpack this concept, spend a little bit of time just unpacking this concept of technological refusal, because this speaks to certainly the theme of the politics of inequality, where we're looking at practices of resistance and a bottom-up approach. So when I talk about technological refusal, I'm referring to a body of practices that come from individuals and organized groups against coercive technologies, against technological systems or socio-technical systems that are imposed on people and that minimize choice, freedom, and well-being. And when I'm talking about technological refusal, really there are three dimensions of it that we can glean from the literature that focus on rejection, resistance, and refusal. So just really briefly, right? Rejection, you might reject a specific technology, right? You might unadopt Facebook because you don't support, I don't know what might be a principled, right? You don't support how they've been complicit with, for example, the Capitol, the insurrection at the US Capitol, right? So you might unadopt Facebook. You might resist, but keep in mind that refusal, technological refusal, is neither absolute nor purist, right? So you could give up Facebook, but you might not necessarily give up Google search, right? Just like you might give up meat, but you might still shop at these stores that are part of big agriculture and a problematic global supply chain of for food. Right, so instead of being absolutist and purist, technological refusal, like other forms of refusal we've seen theorized in other contexts of violence and coercion, like slavery and how it's conceptualized by post-colonial theorists and Black scholars, Black feminist scholars in particular, technological refusal encompasses processes to ensure self-development, how we come to be individuals existing in society, to relate to one another, and to ensure collective self-government. So, I think this is important because there are, if we're looking broadly at the power of discriminatory technologies of power, right? There are three dimensions that kind of factor into the strength of these discriminatory technologies. There's narrative, a narrative dimension, a technical dimension, and a political dimension, right? So technological refusal is sort of butting up against hegemonic narratives around coercion and surveillance, right? That surveillance is good, right? I have nothing to hide. It's what keeps us safe and so forth. Technical dimension, that this idea of technological, that refusal is reacting to, is sort of the opacity of these socio-technical systems, right? That there's so much that we can know and learn about automated computer systems that are underpinning high-tech police surveillance. And then there's a political dimension that practices of refusal are in tension with, right? This idea that technology is efficient and neutral and more accountable, and it is it's a political actor, right? How we engage with it, how we, how it comes to us, is often done in a way that that kind of upends our typical ways of engaging with democratic institutions. Right? It's not as easy, but certainly this concept of and the practice of technological refusal is sort of in conversation and challenging the political dimensions of socio-technical systems or discriminatory technologies of power. Okay, so in the time that I have remaining, because I do want to get to the question of what can we learn, I just want to speak very quickly to three categories of examples of technological refusal. So one comes from the work with my colleagues at Our Data Bodies, which is an all women of color run research and organizing coalition based in the United States between 2015 and 2020. We did extensive qualitative research, participatory research in Detroit, Charlotte, and Los Angeles. And what we found, we did nearly 135 in-depth interviews, as well as a number of group interviews and reflective focus groups in these cities. And so an example of technological refusal that we discovered through this work focuses on the one hand, obfuscation, sort of cloaking oneself within socio-technical systems. And then conversely, sort of intervening in these systems to be accurately represented. So to appear and disappear in these systems. So Ken, for example, in Los Angeles, is a Native American man, unhoused, who encounters police harassment very regularly, talked about sitting on a curb in front of some out of order public toilets, and then being harassed by the police. And the exchange that he shared with us was about the ways in which the police, they tried to ticket him, essentially. And he gave them his real name, but they misheard it. And when they tried to look it up in the police database, they typed in the wrong name. And then he basically reiterated that. He said, yes, that's my name. It's Ken Silvis, when in fact it was Ken Silvio. So he was able to escape being ticketed because of the error of the police, right? So this is an example of a type of technological refusal. Mello, also in Los Angeles, spoke to us about, again, being accurately represented in the coordinated entry system, which allocates beds and welfare services to unhoused people in the area. And she talked about how she was very dogged in trying to figure out why she hadn't been placed in permanent housing. And how many, what she had to go through as an individual to ensure that she could get into the system. The second category of examples, I was trying to speak more quickly, refers to, so we're not just to give a sense of getting out of the US and European context, the second category, which largely groups with acts of resistance, focuses on protests in India against, actually these protests were across the world, against the company SoftBank. So in South India, owners of small scale hotels trod on the signage of Oyo, which is a startup supported generously by investment funds from the Japanese conglomerate SoftBank. And it's a story of profound economic loss. Essentially, SoftBank started the problem with its Vision Fund, which was flush with money at one point, and they supported startups like Oyo. So Oyo gave enticements to and promises to contractors like small-scale hotel owners in India, such as access to consumers at scale. But ultimately, Oyo could not deliver on the promise, and they stopped payments to these small business owners in their network and effectively bankrupting many, thus prompting a series of protests, again, not only in Kerala, but all over the world where SoftBank had made these investments. So that's in the category of resistance. And then to come back to the examples of data-driven policing, in Los Angeles, a group that our data bodies works with, the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, actually, Stop LAPD Spying Coalition was the anchor organization, or is the anchor organization of within our coalition. In Los Angeles, Stop LAPD Coalition, which started in the early 2010s, it boasts of one of the very few happy stories of in the history of anti-surveillance work or tech abolitionist work. So this is in the refusal category, right? We see in Los Angeles, after years of shutting down the LA Police Commission meetings and documenting disproportionate harm, police harm, intimidation, and violence against Black people, people of color, the unhoused, undocumented immigrants, and poor people in LA, the coalition essentially galvanized support and political momentum for ending the city's predictive policing programs. So in April 2019, Operation Laser was dismantled, and 1 year later, last year, the city announced the end of its its use of PredPol. So here, the campaign was extensive. That we shouldn't, right? It was absolutely extensive. The coalition shut down the meetings, as I mentioned, weekly, the police commission meetings, much to the horror of all of the police commissioners and anybody else in attendance. The coalition, Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, produced a groundbreaking report calling out the racist nature of algorithmic policing. It obtained public records to expose an extensive database of individuals in so-called crime hotspots. It enlisted the academic community to organize against researchers responsible for developing PredPol, the predictive policing technology adopted by the LAPD. It met weekly with members of the community to talk about the impacts of surveillance. And the connection with our data bodies is it used stories from our data bodies to illuminate the lasting and debilitating effects of surveillance in the lives of marginalized people. So, and up against these stories and the evidence, the LA Police Commission eventually backed down. So between their decision and the report of the Inspector General, the Stop LAPD coalition's impact is undeniable, right? They had been absolutely dogged in the refusal to accept surveillance and absolutely dogged in a particular type of refusal, tech refusal, right? This is an abolitionist perspective, right? We've seen this abolitionist perspective appear in other cases of tech refusal. I'll just mention them really quickly. So Mi Gente, an organization based in San Jose, that is supporting Latinx communities across the United States, has waged a very in-depth campaign against called No Tech for ICE. And I'll just mention one of our table members with the Justice, Equity, and Technology table, No Tech for Tyrants, recently launched its work around organizing students in several universities. Sorry, I'm trying to find the link. Here it is. Several universities throughout the UK to essentially try and de-link between research on police tech and the academy. So, sorry, let me just pull up there. So this is No Tech for Tyrants website, Oxford, Cambridge, St. Andrews, Edinburgh. By the way, LSE does not appear here. So any students in attendance or tuning in to this meeting, right, something to consider. So they're looking at the relationship between higher education institutions and violent technologies, equipping tech workers with what they need to know to kind of understand the impacts of technology and trying to hold technology accountable, and hosting many teach-ins, workshops, talks for practitioners and activists and academics. Okay, so that should give you an idea of technological refusal. So let me just repeat that really quickly. Again, I conceptualize technological refusal with respect to self-development and collective self-government, right? So it's not just organized action, though that is exciting. And I think these examples from Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, No Tech for Tyrants, Mi Gente are important. It's not only organized collective action, though. You can see elements of everyday resistance, rejection, and refusal, right? So within the context of your daily life, right, finding the workaround to the coercive nature of technology, however that coerciveness is practiced, is as important to technological refusal as these organized forms of collective refusal or tech abolitionism, as I've highlighted. So in each of these three cases I've presented, I would argue again that they're challenging narrative power, the technical power, and the political power that accrues in relation to these socio-technical systems. But unfortunately, and this is where I want to sort of land the discussion and open it up for thought, is that especially with the last category that I've been outlining, talking about tech abolitionism, these cases tend to function as exceptions. They're not the norm. Now, let me just say, so in the United States, there are very few cities across the country that have, for example, implemented full-scale bans against predictive policing. We could say the same about facial recognition technology. And I want to acknowledge, though, I want to acknowledge that there's plenty to say about how movements can evolve and emerge in their practices of technological refusal. And in fact, that is in part what the Justice, Equity, and Technology Table members are doing. So we could talk about infrastructure that needs to be in place, practices of co-liberation and solidarity that need to be seeded and grow. That is definitely an important organizing conversation that needs to and is increasingly taking place in Europe. And certainly we see this in the United States. But what I want to wonder about out loud is what we can learn from other movements of technological refusal. And, this is me putting on, sort of working within a dialectical framework and putting on my Grace Lee Boggs hat. For those of you that know Grace Lee Boggs, she's a great organizer, community organizer in the United States that comes from a Hegelian tradition and talks about evolution, not revolution. And in my, best attempts to kind of embody some of the dialectical thinking of Grace Lee Boggs, want to ask again, what can we learn from other movements of technological refusal that aren't neatly within this space of racial justice organizing, right? Supporting and growing resilience within minoritized and racialized communities. What can we learn? So to do that.
So Sita. Yes. We have about 20 minutes left.
Yes.
Do you want to jump into the... Yeah, okay, yeah. Good.
So go ahead. I'm just going to mention really quickly that what kind of caught my fancy is, let's see if I can get to this really quickly, was this series of anti-5G stories that have cropped up over the last, the last year, right? Anti-5G activists, not just in Europe, though I think I've been more attuned to these stories in Europe, but around the world, right? Have been burning down cell phone towers because they think erroneously that somehow these towers are going to make you more susceptible to COVID-19, right? And so we have these examples of anti-5G activism that, right, express both sort of individual level concerns with socio-technical systems and collective level concerns with socio-technical systems. But we're not, it's very unlikely, and this is what made me think twice about recording this conversation, right? Like, it's not ordinary that we would group conversations about racial justice and police abuse and police violence with anti-5G activists. But I wonder what, if anything, can we learn from that? And so I'm going to stop here somewhat cheekily, because I'd love to hear from all of you about what you think, first and foremost, about technological refusal, and second, whether you think it's important to move outside the boundaries, in this case, racial justice, high-tech policing, right, to think about technological refusal in order to move from the exception to the norm, right? So that what happened in LA around tech abolitionism won't be the exception. We'll see more of that practice worldwide. So I'll end there.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you very much, Sita. That's been a fascinating kind of, you know, whirlwind through all these different projects that you're doing. And to reiterate, if you have a question for Sita, then please either put it in the chat or raise your hand, not in the video because I can't see everybody all the time. So if you go into the chat or into your function, the participants, you should be able to raise your hand. If you know there is no questions, I'm also happy. I think Sita, if you are happy to, for people just to unmute themselves. But I see that Martina Tasioli has a question. So please, Martina, if you want to unmute yourself, then go ahead and ask the question you had.
Yeah, can I ask live or?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the great talk. No, I was just, I mean, I don't have maybe a specific question, but it's more about, so you ended up by asking us, what do you think about technological refusal? And you made a distinction between refusal and resistance. And I was wondering if, in your opinion, part of this impasse, right, that we all face in, like, conceptualizing resistance and refusal in relation to technology and mobilizing at the same time similar examples, is that it also depends on the analysis of power and how we analyze power associated enacted through technology. So as long as power is conceived only in terms of repression or repression, there is also very specific image of what is resistance, what is refusal, right? So I was wondering if, together with discrimination and this like negative connotation, I don't want to say that I don't want to defend this discriminatory technology, but just to say, if we look at how this technology generate in terms of new economic spaces and new political spaces, also the practice of resistance that we can highlight might be different than just a symmetrical opposition or withdrawal from technology. So I was wondering if, in your opinion, but it's a real question and it's not only related to your specific presentation, if in this critical literature on racialized technology, there is this tendency of framing power in a certain way, a reason why then we frame resistance in a certain way. We conceptualize our resistance in a certain way.
I mean, I'll say thanks for those comments. I'll answer that or respond very personally and then, kind of in a hopefully reflexive manner. So I come from 20 years of organizing within spaces of information and communication technology. And for a good 13 years, was very enthusiastic about technology, right? About its generative nature, right? About its democratic possibilities, about the importance of expressive technologies for the evolution and advancement of social, racial, and economic justice. But with the advent, I mean, there's a longer story behind it, right? Like, we've been sold for from birth to adolescence of digital technology, right? We've been sold this narrative of its democratizing potential. We've been sold it. And I think with automated technologies and the sheer, I think as has been put in the chat, right, the sheer infrastructural power that exists right now, and not just the sort of easy big tech targets, but the lesser known tech companies, the sheer infrastructural power that they have, I think is a sobering moment for us to really question and focus on the, you know, coercive, repressive, oppressive sides of technology. That's not to say that technological refusal is anti-technology, or that when you focus on coercive technologies that you only want to subtract, not build. I think the point of this concept is that it's very much tied to reimagining, right? Political reimagining of socio-technical systems. So that might come with how we think about ownership, right? That might come with how we redefine health and safety, community health and safety. So I'll leave it at that. But yeah, I think we're at a critical moment where the biggest innovations that we need are ones related to how we can govern these technologies rather than having these technologies govern us, because that's actually what's happening.
Yeah, just to clarify, I didn't want to say that I see technology in a more positive sense than you, or that I believe in this democratization narrative. My question is rather, how do we conceive power, right? That the power do not, and doesn't mean that it's positive, but also in this negative connotation, does it work mainly through repression and discrimination? This is, well, just say that I don't want to buy the narrative of democratizing technology or technology for social good. It's more about how does power works and technological power. But
thank you very much. I think Sita, you kind of inadvertently touched on a comment there by Syed, sorry if I mispronounced your name, who said in the chat that he suggests that the issue of technological refusal needs to be considered in relation to or in tension with the issue of infrastructure dependency, which you kind of touched upon in that later. So maybe in a minute you might want to comment on that again, but I would like to first give the word to Armin Ishkanian, who's been have had her hand up for a while. So Armin, please go ahead.
Thanks, Ellen. Thanks, Sita. Great talk. I like how you bring together rejection, resistance, and refusal. So I have two questions that are interconnected. You talked about the everyday forms of resistance, refusal, and obfuscation, and kind of the localized actions, you know, against LAPD, against, you know, particular cities, police departments. And I was thinking, I was wondering, you know, what levers do these tech abolitionist movements have for more national level, or in the US state level, you know, policy changes or legislative changes? And particularly given the confluence of corporate power, corporate interests and national security and policing interests and power. And the second and interconnected question is, are they linking with, I mean, you know, maybe not so much with the 5G movement, but with other movements such as the online privacy movement, you know, which is concerned again about how technology is being used. So those two questions around, you know, repertoires of action and the ability to shape policy or legislation.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not a social movement scholar, but I spend a lot of time and do consider myself an organizer. Or spend time with organizers and consider myself an organizer. And I would just say that, you know, the case of the US is really, there's like exceptionalism all over the place, right? So there's exceptionalism in how organizing happens in the US due to, yeah, just many factors, one of which is just how the US civil rights movement evolved. But there is quite a lot of national level organizing. There's sort of the, I would call it like the professional level organizing, so like more formal and splashy coalitions. And then there is on the ground, work that's on the ground, but still sort of connecting between different organizations working against deportation, for example, or well, a lot around deportation, actually, criminalizing sex workers, trans and queer people, et cetera. So there is, I think, in the U.S., a lot of signs, I think, very like exciting signs of like people coming together and thinking across domains and thinking across contexts. That is still within the context of like a highly polarized and complicated political environment where there, you know, it's just, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of burnout, and there's, there's a new administration, which is very confusing. you'll see, for example, I think actually today there's a new campaign that has launched called Eyes on Amazon that brings together organizers and activists that are concerned about racialized surveillance capitalism and want to call out Amazon for its various misdeeds, up and down the supply chain that it controls. So yeah, in Europe, I'll just say really quickly that I think that we're seeing a very different, I mean, I would love for my colleagues, Esra and Sana, to jump in here, but I think we're seeing something that is uniquely different, or Esra, uniquely different, that is, has to contend with like linguistic and regional issues and, you know, the complications of not just EU law, but a very particular history around systemic and institutionalized racism that, I think engages a different kind of work. But like the work of the table, and I think there are other pockets of activity, there is a real hunger to try and connect between different localized actions.
Thank you, Sita. I see that there's two hands raised and then another person who let me know that they would like to ask a question. So I think maybe what I'll do is I'll group the three together, and then I hope, Sita, that you can give a very quick answer to the, you know, since we're kind of wrapping up the event, sadly, to those. And I'm sure, Sita, but do tell me if I'm wrong, that you'd be happy to continue the conversation outside of the this particular virtual space in another
yes,
one.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So Safia, I'm not completely sure how to pronounce your name, but please go ahead. And then I'll ask Lee Edwards and Anna Valdivia to ask their questions. But Safia, please go first, and then we'll get to the other questions that were posed.
Thank you. And thank you, Sita, for the very insightful talk. So Mike, I just wanted to make sure that I understood a point correctly, because you mentioned, so I've noticed, we've all noticed, you've mentioned the US a lot, which make me think, I'm not sure, and I'm just trying to assess the situation in Europe, so is it safe to not assume, but like, so what I've understood is that in the US, the use of tools and partnerships with companies for police surveillance is much more developed and widely in place. Is that, I'm just wondering if that's like as much the case in Europe, and if not, that made me think, is that like a great like point, like for all of us, all Europeans organizers, to keep in mind.
Thank you, Sophia. Lee, please go ahead with your question, and then you can collectively answer all three of them.
Hi, thanks. Really fantastic talk. I really enjoyed it. I just had a question about the, it kind of relates to Sayed's point about infrastructure in the chat as well. In terms of the communications infrastructure, the public relations industry and the stratcoms industries are enormously important in promoting this dominant narrative of tech as hopeful, you know, future development oriented, only ever positive. And I just wondered whether any of the activism that you've seen or been involved with has actually addressed not so much just the tech companies themselves, but the people responsible for developing the messaging that the tech companies in part use, because they all will be employing these companies to help them promote their kind of products and that kind of view of the world that they benefit from. I just wondered whether you'd come across any activism particularly focused on them. And maybe also where you see it fits in terms of the kind of technological refusal.
Thank you, Lee. Anna, please go ahead.
Thank you. So my question is more related with our personal context. And I have a PhD from Spain, and now I'm a postdoc here in King's College London. And then I realized that racial justice and critical data studies are 100% Anglo-Saxon centered. So my question is how we can define technological refusal and resistance from other cultures or countries or nationalities?
All great questions. Sita, I think it's okay if we go a little bit over. I hope I will get, no doubt, like kind of like poked if that's not the case, but please do take your time to answer the questions properly, and then people can get in touch after the event with you.
Yeah, because I think maybe let me try and combine Mustafa's question in the chat with Anna's question that was just posed. So I think they're related. So I think the conversation around sort of optimism is very, positivist understanding of technology really needs to be undone. Right? I think we need some new conceptual anchors to help explain how we understand technology. And what I say in various, I mean, like in my organizing context, like people think I'm a little bit nuts because I'll say things like, well, you know, obviously we need to come up with a new word to define technology because it comes from like colonial racist roots, right? Like it's something that was used to delineate between civilized and uncivilized populations. And so maybe that's part of, you know, a route into addressing what Anna was saying about, yeah, like having a wider expanse through which to understand refusal and really see the widest potential of this concept. So I know that's very short, but I think hopefully that, yes, gets to Mustafa's and Anna's points. About Sophia's question, which I think is also related, right? Like, how do we get out of the US mold? Again, like the US is exceptionalist in so many regards. What I do appreciate, I think, is just thinking about what we can learn from, I mean, it's almost as if like you can learn to not focus on certain things too, right? In the context of US racial justice organizing, there are things that might not be as important to prioritize. I think in the European context, as I was saying earlier, certainly what I've started to learn over the years and what I learned from my colleagues, Esra and Sana, is just, thinking about the state in a different way than it's usually thought about in the US. Thinking about community power in a different way, right? And what that looks like here in Europe. And also, yeah, having like referencing a different history, right? And all of those things, I think, inform what will be an organizing strategy, right? Knowing that specific past is, I think, essential to crafting the answer to the question, what do we want, right? What we want, we collectively, quote unquote, right, in Europe is very different from what exists in the US. So I think that we're going to learn in Europe in different ways. It might not be this big, you know, Eyes on Amazon campaign or No Tech for ICE, right? Like, it's done in a different way in Europe. And I think that's also very powerful and important. Just on the point that Lee raised about PR companies and getting at that narrative, I think that there are many groups that are, I mean, all the groups that I work with in coalition in the US are hyper aware of the dominant narratives. And so they're trying to specifically target these. Whether or not they're doing a good job is another thing. I think, you know, No Tech for Tyrants is focusing on an area that actually, by focusing on the link between academia and high-tech policing, I think that's actually really important. Might be in some ways more important to unpick and challenge than the narrative element, because I think those narratives are born there and they grow in that petri dish there, right? Like about technology, and then it, you know, I don't know, I just like thinking about all of the impact and engagement strategies that all of these big, huge research projects have to put forth, right? Like, it's in their bones, right? And that is highly, highly problematic.
Thank you. What do we want? I think that's a very important question to ask for the future in this field, and how can we get there, right, to this future through collective action and individual awareness and consciousness raising. So thank you so much, Sita. I think I speak on behalf of everybody saying that this was an amazing talk and discussion. I hope it was useful for you as well to kind of develop your further thoughts and work. And we look forward to hearing more about it as you progress and things come along. So yeah, please do get in touch, everybody, and have a look at the Inequalities Institute's website to see future events. And we hope to see you tomorrow, and if not tomorrow, next week. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.